This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Police said today a deadly stabbing spree in the southern English town of Reading is being treated as terrorism. Three people died and three others are seriously injured. Police arrested a 25-year-old man on suspicion of murder after the Saturday evening stabbings at a park in a city about 40 miles west of London. A spokesperson for Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he held a meeting Sunday with security officials, senior ministers, and police to be updated about the investigation. German authorities expressed shock Sunday over a rampage of an unprecedented scale overnight in the city center of Stuttgart, where hundreds of partygoers ran riot, attacking police and looting stores after smashing shop windows. Police report 19 colleagues hurt and 24 people provisionally arrested, half of them German nationals. Stuttgart's police chief said they were, quote, unbelievable scenes that have left him speechless in his 46 years of police service. He has never experienced anything like this. Police say tensions built up shortly after midnight when officers carried out checks on a 17-year-old German man suspected of using drugs. Crowds immediately rallied around the young man and began flinging stones and bottles at police. Police in the Midwestern U.S. city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, say one person was killed and 11 others were injured in a shooting spree early Sunday morning. The city has been at the heart of a wave of anti-racism protests in the United States and around the world over the death of George Floyd. He's the black man who died in Minneapolis police custody last month after a police officer had his knee on his neck for about 9 minutes. There was no indication the shooting was related to that incident. For more on these and other stories, visit us at voanews.com or download our app. This is VOA News. A report posted on a Minnesota newspaper website early Sunday says when the former police officer accused of killing Floyd was brought to the county jail for booking, all correction officers of color were instructed to go to another floor. The Minneapolis Star Tribune said the eight officers have filed discrimination charges with Minnesota's Department of Human Rights. The corrections officers told the newspaper the action taken against them is the, quote, most overtly discriminatory act, end quote, they have ever experienced while working for Ramsey County. Derek Chauvin faces third-degree murder and manslaughter charges in connection with George Floyd's death May 25th. Users of the popular video sharing app TikTok and Korean pop music fans are being partly credited for inflating attendance expectations at U.S. President Donald Trump's first political rally in months. Social media users on different platforms claim in posts and videos they registered for free tickets to Saturday's rally in the U.S. city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, as a prank with no intention of going. Prior to the event, the president's campaign manager said there had been more than 1 million ticket requests for the event. Local authorities say about 6,200 people showed up at the 19,000-seat BLK Center arena. Mr. Trump and Vice President Mike Pence canceled speeches to an expected overflow crowd. Attendees largely did not wear face masks at the rally, despite concerns of health officials over the coronavirus pandemic. Worldwide, more than 464,000 people have died from COVID-19. In the hardest-hit country, the United States, the number is closing in on 120,000. Confirmed infections around the world sit at just over 8.8 million and more than 2.2 million in the U.S. Spain reopened its borders with France Sunday, getting rid of one of the most potent symbols of Europe's battle against the coronavirus. Europeans are just emerging from some of the world's toughest lockdowns, with cars trickling across the reopened Spain-France border early Sunday, a day after Italy enjoyed its first top-flight football match in 103 days. In France, millions of children prepare to return to school Monday after 3 months away. Thousands of miles away, on the fringes of Eastern Europe, cases have spiked again in Azerbaijan, forcing the government to institute another lockdown, irritating local workers. China banned imports from top U.S. poultry producer Tyson Foods and ordered a Beijing Pepsi factory to close Sunday. This as authorities clamped down on food production and distribution amid a new coronavirus cluster in the capital. The General Administration of Customs says imports of frozen chicken from Tyson's Foods have been temporarily suspended. A statement added chicken products from Tyson's that have already arrived in China will be confiscated. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Rule of law supposed to come up with proof. And this is the beginning of the new phase. The new Congo fights corruption as well as to fight impunity and rampant embezzlement that characterize the government out there in the Congo.
A top aide to DRC's president receives jail term for corruption.
Who really appreciate our position really, appreciate our action. From all what you can see as a journalist, what's happened from yesterday, from the day they arrested me and what I do. For people who really appreciate the effort by our organization.
A Nigerian pressure group calls on the government to step up efforts to address the growing insecurity challenges across the country.
For I intend on securing, from an empathic point of view, bear in mind, I've been through a vigorous process before I got to where I am. I used to be too humble, too empathetic, to everything, but right now it's a battle between the narcissist government and the super empire.
And a Botswana artist calls on the government to ensure the natural resources benefit the people. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Democratic Republic of Congo political activist has welcomed as a positive development the jail sentence handed down to Vital Kamerhe, chief of staff of President Felix Tshisekedi. Jean-Michel Mundela says the court ruling should send shivers down the spine of corrupt public officials who, he says, embezzle public funds without consequences. Kamerhe's lawyer signaled there would be an appeal to the ruling, but some Congolese say the ruling sends a strong signal that the old ways of embezzling public funds and getting away with it are gone. Analysts also say if this anti-corruption drive continues, it will signal to the investment community that the DRC is committed to doing business that meet international standards. Political activist Jean-Michel Mundela tells me that the fight against corruption needs to be sustained to ensure the protection of the public purse.
This is just to show that for so long the country was going through the process of impunity. People were playing with government funding without any control. And this showed that the new government or the new regime tried to put an end to embezzlement and impunity that has been plagued the country for so long.
Now, how are the people of Congo reacting to this development?
Called the capital earlier today, Kinshasa. People were pleased, happy, relieved, actually, to say that someone the judicial system now, I understand that, you know, it is important to punish this kind of behavior and to put an end to bring an exemplary punishment to someone who conduct himself irresponsibly toward a government fund, a state fund that belongs to everybody. Those who are in charge of managing and leading the whole country, in the past, they were doing whatever they want to do, no accountability at all. At this stage, it shows that people feel that someone understands their cries that was going for so long.
So supporters of Vital Kamerhe, a strong ally of President Felix Tshisekedi, are of the opinion that this is just a setup. Because during the trial, Mr. Kamerhe said that he did nothing without the explicit authority of the president or perhaps officials in the government. How do you respond to that?
This is the misdirection that Mr. Kamerhe geniusly presented to say that, you know, he was working under direction of the president. Yes, of course, he was under the president's direction that he authorized to fund those 100 days infrastructure program. But the president was not behind Mr. Kamerhe to tell him that you need to embezzle those funds and misuse those funds for personal use. Mr. Kamerhe was alone out there. The president who could not be on the field or could not hire the company or the contractor to execute the project. Mr. Kamerhe is the one that did those, execute the project at the end and misuse the fund. Okay? So he misled the president and he abused the president's trust. That's the key here.
So what should be the expectations of Congolese following this decision and the prosecution and the jail time that Vital Kamerhe received? Is this a new phenomenon? Is this the beginning of the fight against corruption in Congo?
It is the beginning. And as the president, during the campaign, the UDPS had fought for so long just for rule of law in the Congo. The Congo has been run from Mobutu era to Kabila and then to Kabila under the absence of rule of law. So the UDPS from the get-go was trying to implement the rule of law in which everybody, whoever, whatever position you occupy, you will be subject to the rule of law. So this is the beginning of the new phase, the new Congo. The Kamerhe trial, something that we have all the proof, and the accusation came, and the process was transparent. Everybody saw the way things went. All the previous case, whoever has a case against someone, you need to come up with a proof. That's the key here. The rule of law is about proof. You come up with a proof, and then the trial takes place, and then whoever will be acquitted will be acquitted, and whoever will be condemned will be condemned. But the rule of law supposed to come up with a proof. And this is the beginning of the new phase, the new Congo, fight corruption as well as to fight impunity and rampant embezzlement that characterized the government out there in the Congo.
Jean-Michel Mundela is a Democratic Republic of Congo political activist. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Still in the DRC, the Mahoro Peace Association has reiterated calls for the international community to help end the continuing attacks against the Banyamulenge. The group says the National Army, or the FARDC, and the United Nations Force, or MONUSCO, are not doing enough to protect the unarmed civilians. Some Banyamulenge men say they will take up arms to protect themselves and the community, since they argue neither the government nor the international community are making serious efforts to protect them from the rebels. But Adele Kibasumba, leader of the Mahoro Peace Association, dismissed the suggestion, saying she does not support vigilante groups. The government, she says, has a constitutional duty to protect life and property. Kibasumba tells me her group remains committed to advocating for the protection of the Banyamulenge and will not be deterred in doing so.
This time we're very concerned about the reoccurring attack that has been happening in a displaced refugee camp under the protection of MONUSCO and the National Army, the FARDC. We've registered about 3 attacks within 3 weeks. It's pretty frustrating because these are not normal attacks, because these attacks are being done in the refugee camp under the protection of FARDC and MONUSCO. So these are different than the normal attacks we're used to.
So when you petition the government and the UN bodies, including Congress, what has been the response about the protection for these Banyamulenges?
We are petitioning every day, but we have not gotten any response. Instead, we have basically have clear evidence that the FARDC is aiding the rebel groups to attack these camps, because we do not understand how a camp that is under protection of the FARDC, a few kilometers away, the Mai Mai is coming and going as they please. They attack and they kill people. They steal cows. On May 28th, there was the first attack, which left 6 people wounded. One woman succumbed to the injuries and she died yesterday. And on June 13, we had Mai Mai come and steal 5 cows. And just yesterday again, the FARDC itself attacked the camp and injured 2 people, one being 69-year-old man, and one was handcuffed and then shot by the FARDC, not Mai Mai.
Now, when you presented the petition to the government, because I understand there's a new sheriff in town, the president has committed to protecting life and property. Some resources have been given to the FARDC to protect people, including the police. What has come of it?
for us, we have not really seen any change at all. In fact, the generals who are commanding these operations are the same generals that were there way before the new government was in place, one being General Mondo, who is sanctioned by the United States and the European Union. I don't know how still a general that's still commanding these important areas that need stabilization. I think if we would see any change, we would see them being removed and not be given these important posts that requires stabilization, especially in an area like Eastern Congo. And I mean, this is a guy who destabilized Beni and he's still in charge. So yes, we would like to see these people not conduct operations or even be in charge of them because they are biased and they're corrupt and they aid Mai Mai and the rebel groups to continue to destabilize the area.
I understand some officials at the U.S. Congress have listened to your petition and is acting on it. What can you tell me about this?
Well, after we petitioned the Secretary General, we had not gotten any response. We went to the U.S. Congress because they tend to listen to their constituency. Some of them are responding, especially the Foreign Affairs Committee, and they have responded and they're inquiring about the steps that have been done by the MONUSCO and also by the UN in general, the steps that they have been taking to address this ethnic cleansing that's being done to the Banyamulenge. So that's definitely a step in the right direction, but we are going to continue. It's not enough, but inquiry is necessary. They need to respond to the acts that are being done to these people, and because they're acts of, I would say, genocide, and it needs to be taken care of.
Let me ask you this, Adele. Some Banyamulenges are encouraging their brothers and sisters to arm themselves to defend themselves against attacks by those you accused of being even members of the FARDC or not being taken care of or being protected by MONUSCO. Is this the stance of your organization?
You know, these attacks and this violence has been going on for 2 years. Not one day the Banyamulenge community has encouraged the civilians to arm themselves to fight against the government. You cannot fight against your parents. The government is our parents. We cannot fight them, but we plead with them. But there are instances where the civilians are not going to wait for them to be chopped. If they have anything to defend themselves, to stand on their ground, I cannot tell them because they are the ones there. They're experiencing the violence. They're being killed and violated every single day. But never once the community or at least our organization have encouraged the civilians to fight against their own government. That would never happen. We still wait for our parents to protect us. We plead with our government to protect us. They're the ones that need to do their job, not the civilians to fight them. It's not what we want.
Adele Kibasumba is the president of the Mahoro Peace Association. She spoke with me from New York. A Ugandan human rights activist says the new roadmap launched by the Electoral Commission will cause confusion ahead of next year's elections. Attorney Isaac Samakadi, CEO of Legal Brains Trust, says the Electoral Commission should review its revised election plans by engaging political parties and stakeholders. The roadmap, officials say, includes a new condensed timeline and guidelines about campaigning. The new guidelines involve virtual campaigns due to the global pandemic caused by the coronavirus. This as the government imposed movement restrictions to limit the spread of the disease. Attorney Isaac Samakadi tells me that the Electoral Commission must do more to address concerns of opponents of the president in order to prevent suspicions and tension, which, if not addressed, he says, will create voter apathy and violence.
It's requiring them to organize their number flag bearers and announce the head of the nomination process impossible because of internal party democracy requirements. And lastly, political parties, the commission does not give a free, fair and credible election. It has an example to make shortcuts.
The Electoral Commission, the electable timeline gives the political parties enough time to prepare for next election. They announced the time to ensure all these things are. They insist that with revised roadmap due to COVID-19 gives the political parties the know-how in order to plan them accordingly. Disagree with that?
Well, we don't have much. That all were caught off guard by the pandemic is a given. Main concern for that is that when the Electoral Commission woke up clarity that COVID may be here for a long time, it must fulfill the constitution to deliver a free, fair and credible election within set and constitution. The Electoral Commission bore caution to the wind and not consult the parties. I think that is the major reaction. So the good news is that right now we are from a middle of the e-platform, the iPod, with the Electoral Commission, and they have worked together moving forward. Has emphasized roadmap is tentative, and it will be adjusted in accordance with the feedback it's receiving from the police and other stakeholders. All parties understand the need to move forward.
Isaac, this is the thing, and you know the world over to the coronavirus, things are being worked out differently. So normal campaign of old cannot be replicated new dispensation with the spread of the corona if there's no social distancing and other medical measures to curb the spread of it. How does the opposition alongside the Electoral Commission in order not to put the lives of their supporters in jeopardy during this pandemic?
We are awake and alive of COVID. However, democracy is still coping with this reality. It does not mean that democracy must die to survive COVID. The two are non-negotiable. There is a middle that there is a delicate balance fashioned in consultation with all stakeholders to deliver democracy in a that is sensitive, the right and duty to protect. I should say here that the concern of the political parties in the commission have taken a very paternalistic treating citizens and their political parties and associations as though they were children who must be taken to lack consent and autonomy, who must be taken to be unable to follow basic social distancing regulations, who cannot wear masks, who cannot sanitize, who cannot be given charge of decisions concerning their privacy, health and their life, as well as that of the public. I think that's the wrong approach. Already, we see citizens returning to work, especially in the lockdown. We don't understand the contradiction why citizens out then in equitably gatherings, not exist as we knew them before, but equitably registered gatherings, the purpose, political participation pandemic. The parties agree with total ban on gathering and the right of movement of political actors dangerous and for great loss of life are likely to die from police brutality in the name of COVID control measures.
Now let me ask you this, Isaac. Why are these political parties of the union that the Electoral Commission planning not to organize free, fair, transparent, and credible elections, despite the fact the Electoral said that it is willing to work with and other stakeholders for the elections?
Well, the Electoral Commission put the cart before the horse on, or should I say Tuesday, on when it, in a state level, shall ban, and the only manner of campaign shall be digital, giving details. And details were requested for the Electoral Commission. Our commissioner spoke of you only speak on TV and social media. That's a very limited form and manner of conducting campaigns, which probably is not sufficient to meet the constitutional standard of involving most people in Uganda. Due to our own political reality, radio stations located within the center of Eastern Uganda, they are private individuals who, as we show, the reputed owners subscribe to the ruling party. Sadly, there have been documented instances of exclusion of people with divergent views from those of the ruling party and establishment from accessing radio stations, television stations in Uganda. Social media use in Uganda is policed by the Media and Cyber Crimes Unit and other spy agencies that are partisan in nature. And the expression of dissenting views on social media has been punished through judicial harassment of those who have these views, like Dr. Stella Nyanzi and so many others that we have seen in the last decade. So this particular limitation is seen as being an unreasonable way of balancing the need, balancing public health and human rights in the context of a free and fair election. We think they are far better proportionate modes of managing campaigns than the three options that the Electoral Commission is putting on the table.
Attorney Isaac Semakade is the CEO of Legal Brains Trust. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Alassane Mulemogi, a popular Botswana artist, is calling on the government to establish policies and laws to benefit the public. Ati, as he is affectionately called by his teeming fans, says he is ready to die for his cause if the administration fails to do right by the people. His comments come after embarking on a solo protest in parts of the capital, Habaroni. He expressed concern that consecutive governments have failed citizens by signing deals with foreign companies which did not benefit the people. Ati says he has made several efforts to have government officials to address his concerns but failed. Speaking with me, Alassane Mulemogi says his aim is to ensure that the natural resources of Botswana benefit the people.
For many years, I've had aspirations and dreams of which I've always felt were impossible due to the environment that I find myself within. And as I grew up and got to understand and comprehend a whole lot of things, I got a deeper, frustrating understanding that the policies that are put in place are merely just cloaked to entice people into voting for a certain political party to get into power, only to be disappointed for nothing to be rendered in as far as action taking is involved. I had a long shot. I mean, if I was going to ever try to fix things in my land and make things compatible with the dreams and aspirations of young African Botswana, then I would have to come up and devise a plan that would take maybe more than 15 years.
Ati, specifically, what do you want change in Botswana?
I want the government to draw up a legislation that protects the interests of the people of the land. Like, you know, the world, you know, speaks of Botswana in so many beautiful ways. I don't know if it's because the countries that glorify Botswana's peace and successful economy are the ones that are actually parasiting on the economy or what. But one thing that I understand is our government is corrupt like nobody's business. And a tactic of fear, a mind game of fear has always been used. Nobody being able to talk on the injustice that's going on. And I put it upon myself and I was like, you know what? If I can ask to meet the president and the president doesn't want to meet me, then that must say a lot about who I am and how I can coerce with. And that on its own told me you need to get up and take power in your own hands. I'm in a position whereby even if there's a need for war, I am ready because this particular plan of mine has been a plan that I've always had. And that's why before I ventured into politics, I made sure that I become the most talented and the most influential artist our generation will ever see. And that's why right now my plan is only beginning to unfold.
Let me ask you this. How are the people of Botswana, Matswana as they call them, reacting to this, your dream or your plan to change how things are done in Botswana?
Botswana are waking up and a lot of Botswana are running behind me. But I don't depend on Botswana to physically back me up and walk with me in the fight for freedom because I am ready to die. Like, I'm going to go to that state house with or without support, and I'm going to demand that the president steps down, even if it involves me manhandling the president to step down.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think you'll be putting yourself in danger? And some of your views, some Botswanans will say that, or Matswana would say that, it will undermine the political stability of Botswana, which has been seen as a bastion for stability and peace across Africa.
I don't parade my life based on an image that is not true. I would rather have chaos and have peace. You know, there is no peace here. If by definition of peace, peace is people being unable and forced into mute state, then that's not peace. And that's what I intend on destroying. And any and every Western country that has been benefiting from this country will hear from a guy that came and cut off the cord. If anything, I am ready to put my life on the line. And if anybody has been making more than what the natives have been making from what is rightfully theirs, have a different thing coming. The day that the African child is rising has come. And that's the uprising that I'm bringing along. I don't believe in relations that are toxic. politic. And that's what I'm cutting off right now.
Ati, so what is your next line of action? What do you plan on doing? Because definitely,
my next
line of action is militant.
I was saying my next move is war. My next move is political deconstruction.
Now, so do you plan on containing or facing the backlash that will come with this militant view of war against what you described as the bad or worse things in society and deconstructing the status quo?
There is a plague of corruption. There is a plague of injustice on my land. And whether the community or the society has been indoctrinated to believe that what they've been given is the utmost best life that they can live, I intend on differing. And the true virtue and nature of leadership is to be ridiculed while you give the one who needs that kind of a leadership the leadership that they deserve. And that's what I intend on doing. And quite fortunately, I don't paint or view myself as how another person sees me. I'm a different breed, and the breed that this country has been waiting for has arrived. For I intend on securing, from an empathic point of view, bear in mind, I've been through a vigorous process before I got to where I am. I used to be too humble, too empathetic, too everything. But right now, it's a battle between the narcissist government and the super empire.
Adlasaone Molimogi is a popular Botswana artist. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, Nastura Ashir Sharif, the chairman of the Nigerian Board of Trustees of the Coalition of Northern Groups, was released by the police following his arrest Tuesday. He was accused of organizing a protest without notifying the authorities, which the police say is a violation of the law. The protest members of his group say it was aimed at pressuring the government to step up efforts to bolster security in the country's northern part. It has expressed concern about violence often carried out by Boko Haram militants and bandits. Local media report an increase in killing of unarmed civilians in several northern states. Nastura Ashir Sharif tells me the police dropped all charges against him when he was released from custody.
Yes, what they said is, first of all, we conducted a peaceful protest in Katsina State without permission, which I think I disagree with it, which I told them, according to the Constitution of the Republic of Nigeria and the judgment passed by the Supreme Court of Nigeria, case Gani Pahimi versus AMPP in Kano, the Supreme Court made it very clear that any citizen who wanted to conduct a peaceful rally, he don't need permission from the police. He need to just notify the police. That is the judgment. So for that one, we informed the police and the SSS, the IGP and the DGSSS, and we have the copy of the acknowledgement of the letter notifying them of our rally dates and everything. Likewise, the Katsina State Police Command and the SSS, we informed them a written, and we have all the acknowledgement.
When they arrested you, didn't you tell them that you have the notification and the correspondence
of
the police notifying them?
Yes, I told them, and I even produced the copies of my documents. That is one. But two, they say they are accusing me of attacking the president's spokesperson, Femi Adesina, for insulting our leader, Professor Angu Abdullahi, which our organization put a rejoinder in which we attack Femi Adesina. So that is the two charges. But later, they released me at the end of the day without any condition. They just say I should be released, and they released me.
So some people suggest that a rejoinder is your constitutional right of speech or an expression as guaranteed by the Constitution.
Exactly.
So what is your lawyer saying about your next line of action to fight these charges?
No, they didn't file any charges against us now. They just released me. But what I want people to understand, Femi Adesina is a journalist who used to insult people. If you check his profile, you'll see it when he was in the newspaper. Now he's a presidential spokesperson. The way he used to address the leaders of Northern Nigeria, particularly Professor Angu Abdullahi, is very bad. The way he attacked Professor Angu Abdullahi in February, and he made the same statement this very just last week. So So that's where we decided to put a rejoinder, and that's why we did that.
The reason why you organized the protest in Katsina was because of what your group said to stop the killing of northerners by armed groups, including Boko Haram and other militants. Does that mean that with this arrest, you will stop organizing the demonstration to press home your demand for the government to do something about the insecurity situation in the north?
No. We are a pressure group. Our group is a pressure group in northern Nigeria, which we deal with several issues to do with our welfare and as citizens. So we must stand by our position. We must continue to defend the interests and the integrity of our people. We have to do that.
So is your group satisfied with the response of the government after you went on the protest?
Well, since the beginning of this banditry in the northwestern Nigeria, for the first time, the IGC, the Director SSS, the National Security Advisor, the DGNIA went to Katsina to make some inquiries, to meet the leadership, obviously, to meet the governor, the traditional institution, at least shows a sign of seriousness from the security side now. And the way the president responded to the security agents, to the service chiefs this evening is encouraging too. But we are about to enter a meeting right away to discuss the situation on ground now. So maybe by tomorrow, 10 o'clock, we'll address a press conference. It is there then we will know what to do and how we are going to respond to the issue.
So what should be the expectations of residents in the northern part of the country in terms of pressure groups' effort to have the government respond
people
to...
People really appreciate our position, really. Yeah, appreciate our action. From all what you can see as a journalist, what's happened from yesterday, from the day they arrested me and what I do. So people really appreciate the effort by our organization.
Let me ask you, when the police released you, did they say there will be a follow-up or this is the end of the case against you?
No, they didn't ask me for any follow-up. Just say I was released, I should just go and say, okay. They didn't ask me for any follow-up or anything like that. They didn't.
Nastura Ashir Sharif is the chairman of the Nigerian Board of Trustees of the Coalition of Northern Groups. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, Nigerian activists are stepping up their fight against an increase in cases of rape, killings and other forms of violence against women. Sunday, they are wrapping up a week of action against sexual violence. For VOA, Gift Agiriga reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The past few months have brought a series of reports of rape at an alarming rate in Nigeria. This month, the Nigeria Association of Women Journalists, NAWOJ, Federation of Women Lawyers, FIDA, civil society organizations and other organizations led 7 days activism calling for the government to take action against sexual violence. Barrister Esther Uzoma is the national coordinator of the Proactive Gender Initiative. She says they were propelled by the rising cases of sexual assault and gender-based violence.
It is an equivalent of the Black Lives Matter we are seeing breaking forth all over America. What we are saying is that women lives matter.
The communication and advocacy director at the Make a Difference Initiative, Lemi Uhebe, says rape should not go unpunished.
Unfortunately, rape in Nigeria has become a pandemic because every day you see 2, 3, 4 cases of rape, child sexual abuse, gang rape, and even murder in many instances.
United Nations Women, the UN Office on Women's Issues, recently reported that cases of gender-based violence in Lagos State tripled from March to April as Nigeria imposed its lockdown to contain the spread of COVID-19. The UN also said that Abuja recorded an increase of rape cases during the lockdown. The president of the Nigeria Association of Women Journalists, Ifeyinwa Omoole, called on parents to educate their children, especially boys, on issues of sexuality.
We need to start to change the mindset of our boys so that we can change the narratives. A situation where boys think that to subdue a woman, you rape her. To revenge on whatever she has done, you rape her. To show her that you are macho, you rape her. Then something went wrong in the upbringing of the boys.
Nigerian's police chief has said that 717 rape incidents were reported between January and May 2020. 631 cases have been prosecuted and 52 cases are still under investigation. Police spokesman Frank Mba said the police force is working with several organizations to fight the increase. He said the Nigeria police force has a formidable gender unit.
We have a gender unit that is spread across the states of the Federation, and personnel that work within the gender units are not just trained as police officers, but they also receive additional trainings as specialized investigators.
Mba says the police force has begun a training program to help to break the conspiracy of silence that has aided rape and a lack of prosecutions in the past. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. This is Nightline Africa Sports. After a three-month stoppage due to COVID-19 pandemic, the Tanzania Premier League resumed last weekend with the country's giants, Simba, Yanga and Azam, battling for supremacy. Leaders and defending champions Simba Sports Club kept their hunt for a hat-trick of league titles alive, despite being held to a 1-1 draw at home by Ruvu Shooting on the second day of action. Despite dropping 2 points, Simba retained a healthy lead in the standings with a 15-point buffer between them and second-placed Azam with 9 rounds of matches remaining. To avoid any further spike of the virus, the Tanzania Football Federation and the government undertook stringent precautions and health protocols in all the matches. Fans were asked to sit at least a meter from each other, and everyone had their temperature taken before accessing the stadium. Also, sanitizers and running water was availed to ensure high levels of hygiene. The players as well had their temperature taken before going into the stadium. Meanwhile, Jwaneng Galaxy FC were declared champions after the Botswana Football Association, BFA, made the decision to end the season due to the challenges posed by COVID-19. A meeting of the BFA Executive Committee decided to end the campaign with the league standings remaining as they were when the season was halted in March. Galaxy led the standings with 41 points, one ahead of second-placed Township Rollers and third-placed Orapa United with 10 rounds of matches left. In athletics, London Marathon organizers are still hopeful of holding the event in October despite the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The 40th edition of the race was originally scheduled for April 26th but was pushed back to October 4th. Race director Hugh Brewster is reported to have said that, I quote, he hopes that the world will have found a way through coronavirus by October. A final update is expected on July 28th. It's the first time the race, a first run in 1981, has been postponed. Nearly 43,000 runners competed last year. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya claimed a record fourth title in the men's elite race, while fellow compatriot Brigid Kosgei took the women's title. Meanwhile, the Great North Run has been cancelled because of the coronavirus pandemic. More than 55,000 runners were due to take part in the half marathon on September 13th in what would have been its 40th year. Runners are eligible for funds or can transfer their entry to next year, according to the organizers. The Junior and Mini Great North Run and the Great North 5 kilometers, which usually takes place on the Saturday before the Great North Run, has also been cancelled. The race founder, Brandon Foster, was quoted describing the cancellation as devastating, adding that this year, being their 40th year, was said to be the greatest ever. He said they had 60,000 entries and it would have been Britain's biggest ever mass participation event. Last year, UK's Mo Farah won the elite men's title, while Kenyans swept the top four slots in the women's race, with Brigid Kosgei taking the title. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Gue mo fanno buono. Ti ho Christian Grave, but please, baby, you can call me Christian Reese. I'll make you fall in love, I'm a thief in the heart. So need it tonight. Baby, your eyes don't lie. I can see you want a little bit of me in your life. I can treat you like the princess you are, but behind closed doors, we can do it all. Ladies first, when I open doors, I got an open mind, let me open yours. You can come see me while I'm on tour, but till then, besito, mi amor.
Thank you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how beautiful and well-crafted a coffin might look, it will not make anyone wish for death. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.